This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg, and it is Labor Day, and so we think it's a good idea to have a conversation about work, and specifically hard work out in the oil patch. That is the subject of the book The Good Hand, a memoir of work, brotherhood, and transformation in an American boomtown. It is by Michael Patrick F. Smith, and it was recently the book of the One Book, One North Dakota Project. And today we are sharing an excerpt from a One Book, One North Dakota webinar as our very own Bill Thomas speaks with Smith about the book.
I was excited to get the chance to talk to Michael Smith about his remarkable book. And Humanities ND asked Clay Jenkinson, humanities scholar, host of the Thomas Jefferson Hour here on Prairie Public, to set things up by giving Michael and me this intro.
Our featured author today is Michael Patrick Smith, someone I've gotten to know pretty well over the last months. Michael is a folk singer and playwright currently based in Central Kentucky. He has also worked as a stage actor, a bartender, junk hauler, furniture mover, bookstore clerk, contractor, receptionist, event producer, driver, office temp, stagehand, waiter, security guard, set fabricator, legal assistant, grocer, oil field hand, and now a writer. The Good Hand is his first book. I read it. I loved it. I think it nails the very center of what the Bakken oil boom was in Western North Dakota. Today's moderator is Bill Thomas. Bill is the director of radio at Prairie Public.
Oh, thanks, Clay. Michael, thanks so much for being here.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Bill. I appreciate the opportunity.
You know, your book has a really long title. The Good Hand, a memoir of work, brotherhood, and transformation in an American boomtown. Did your publishers try to say, like, man, tighten that up, it's too long? Or how'd you come up with such a long title like that?
Well, my title was The Good Hand, and then they wanted a subtitle to sort of...
Oh, so they made it longer, huh?
Yeah, they made it longer. So initially, the book was going to be called Black Gold Rush, and that was when I was working on it. It was mostly... And I was thinking of it at the time as more of less about myself and more kind of about a bit more reportage, a bit more about the boom from a little bit of a distance and kind of this gold rush aspect of it. But as the book got more and more personal, and as the idea of becoming a hand in the oil field became sort of the central, more central to the book, with the publisher, we made the decision to call it The Good Hand. And then, in a committee way, we figured out the subtitle of it. You know, I was really lucky that they let me do it. I kept waiting for my publisher to tell me and my agent to say, you need to scale this back. Like, what's going on here? You know, because for me, I love, you know, there's chapters on Teddy Roosevelt. There's stuff on the tribes in North Dakota. And I love kind of weaving that history throughout it, as well as the ecology of North Dakota and all the oil field stuff and then of course my own personal life. But I was really encouraged just to keep going. And for me, I come from a theater background. This is maybe a little nerdy, but the plays of Brecht, Bertolt Brecht's plays, were really influential when I was thinking about the structure of the book, and that he writes these kind of sprawling epics that contain these really personal, emotional scenes. But that also sort of zoom out to these bigger forces at work in people's lives. And so that to me was a little bit of how I thought about it as I tracked it. But it was a lot. I went through outline after outline after outline to try to feel where to fit stuff in, you know, was a big part of it.
You're also a musician. Did being a musician influence you other ways in this?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I read everything out loud. I sort of like as part of my editing process. That's kind of the last thing that I do. So at the end of this book, when I was finishing the book, I think I read the entire thing out loud 3 times, which took about a week every time. And it's just, for me, it's just the way the musicality of the words, the way the plosives kind of pop, and the rhythm of stuff, and to make sure that the rhythm's working.
Did you think that being a writer and publishing a book, was that a surprise for you? That, I mean, because this book has been so successful and so well regarded. It's gotten a lot of attention and discussion. Many people have said it's the best book about the Bakken oil boom. And how did you end up writing a book?
It was definitely a pretty crooked path for me, I think. And I'd always sort of wanted to write a book, but I always felt like it was something I wanted to do. So I'd worked for years in writing short stories just to try to get good at writing short stories. And I've also written a few plays or a bunch of plays. Most of them aren't very good, but, you know, I kind of just self-taught myself how to write as best as I could. And when I moved out to North Dakota to join the boom, you know, I started sending, you know, I had like some friends who were kind of tracking what I was doing. I didn't want to do a blog or anything public, but I had a group of people who I was sending emails to just about my impressions of what was going on. The response to them was very enthusiastic, and I was getting all these emails back. And for me, I was really by myself in North Dakota. I didn't have any friends and family when I first arrived. So it was a way for me to stay connected to my friends. And my emails just got longer and longer until I'm sending, 20-page Word documents. And people, this little group of buddies, they really stuck with it, a lot of them. And so by the time I left North Dakota, I had something like 200 pages. I thought, okay, I could turn this into a book. I thought it would take me a year, was my idea. Was I'd write it for a year and then I'd get enough of it done that I could sell it and I'd be a whatever. And it took me 7 years, but I did get it done.
How did you end up coming to North Dakota?
Yeah, it was a little bit, there was part of me, I think, who knew that there was a big story, in North Dakota. There's part of me, it's funny because depending on who I talked to, some people before I left, I told them that I was writing a book, but it felt like I had that in the back of my head, I think. But at the same time, I'd never done it. So it was like kind of a pie in the sky idea. And for me, I've been living in New York for a while. I grew up in central Maryland and on a farm. So I grew up in a rural area, but I'd basically been living in cities my whole adult life. And I'd kind of just, in some way, I don't know if it was a midlife crisis or just things kind of weren't coming together for me. And I was finding myself, I was working in an office. I kind of injured my knee and ended up doing more white collar work, which was never, I just never felt fully comfortable in that environment, in this kind of corporate environment. And I think I just had a lot of unresolved trauma. I mean, I talk about it a bit in the book. My dad was a very rough customer. And, I grew up kind of under a constant sort of threat. And I think that for a lot of people who grow up in abusive households, you end up being drawn to kind of high stakes situations. You end up being drawn to things that are exciting, and there's positives to it, because you can become an EMT, you can do something that's like good for society if you're wired that way. And what I was finding was in New York, I was kind of like just, extended adolescence, living in this sort of state of extended adolescence and kind of putting myself in risky situations with drugs and other things like that, that were just kind of burning off steam in a way. And so when I had heard about the boom, and it was ironically, it was my mom who had first kind of brought it up to me because I was complaining about my job. She said, well, you could always work on an oil rig, But I just became kind of like obsessed with just reading the reportage about North Dakota and about the boom. And I started watching there are all these guys on YouTube who are recording themselves while they're sleeping in their trucks and looking for jobs and kind of telling you where to stay. And I got really, really into that. And it all, I talk about this a bit in the book as well, where Hurricane Sandy hit New York. And so there was a big catastrophe. And I ended up volunteering, doing a ton of volunteer work out there and just working to help. We were pounding out the walls and houses that had flooded so that they could try to save the houses. It just kind of awakened in me my love for doing physical work. And my knee, I realized that my knee had healed up enough where I could get around. So I quit my job, and I also, you know, also I thought I was going to make a ton of money.
Right, right. The world was full of stories of, I talked to people like, oh yeah, my friend's kid is making $80,000.
Yeah.
Didn't make a ton of money though, did you?
No, I did not. I did not.
But you got a book, so.
I got a book out of it.
Yeah. You know, I'm really curious about the reactions of different groups of people to the book. I called Chuck at Books on Broadway, and Books on Broadway, I should mention, is Williston, because they sell the book there. And I was curious what he was seeing in terms of people's reactions to the book. And he said, oh, yeah, he said, we sold a lot of copies. And he said, yeah, people think it's a really good book. He said, I think it's a really good book. Then I talked to another guy who he's actually from Grand Forks, but he goes out, works in Williston periodically. He said, wow, I don't know. I heard a lot of people didn't like that book, you know. So, and you probably heard both. Like,
Yeah, they've definitely run the gamut, I would say. But for the most part, you know, I'm still in touch with a good handful of the guys that I worked with who, you know, still live in Williston. Some of them have moved on, but a bunch of them still live in Williston. And thankfully, I can say that they've been really supportive of it, and they've really liked it. You know, it's nerve wracking to give somebody a book and say, "Wow, you're a character in it." You know, here's who you are. And even I would say some of the people that took issue maybe with the way I describe certain things, I feel like pretty much across the board, everybody who's in it, who I'm still in touch with, who's read it, has been supportive and positive. You know, outside of that, it gets, you know, it's a little funny where I've been kind of criticized. It becomes a political issue a bit when there wasn't, not something that I was really honestly even thinking about. Somebody asked me, like, were you trying to write something controversial? You know, and I thought, no, I really wasn't. Like, it just wasn't that much at the forefront of my mind. But I have had some people on the left kind of criticize me for exalting, or what they see as exalting, the oil industry. And I've had people on the right, criticize me for being so rough on the oil industry. I've ended up getting it in the political realm, getting it kind of from both sides. But I think mostly I've been really lucky in that I've gotten positive feedback. You know, I know that some people have felt that I was, I don't know, there's, you know, worried about there's some racism in the book, there's misogyny in the book. Some people have felt that I was a little too tolerant of those things. And then, you know, but never, like, never read the review, like your Amazon reviews. I've learned, because people aren't usually particularly generous on the internet in that way. And a lot of people, I think, really just identify with the personal story of probably most of the messages I get from people are people who either worked in the oil field and it reminded them of the work and they felt validated by it, you know, or people who grew up in abusive families and who kind of identified with that and found some solace in my writing about it and felt that I got that stuff right.
Let me ask a little bit about the workplace culture, because that's one of the things in the book. There's a lot of scenes of what goes on an oil rig and what goes on after hours and everything. A lot of work scenes. One of the Paul Stubbs, who's watching today, he says, how did you fit into that culture there? And did your fellow workers know your background, or did you remain kind of anonymous and quiet?
I started out by being kind of quiet, but as I got closer with people, I became more kind of open about who I was and my ideas. And, you know, it took me a while to fit in. I mean, I've done some construction and, you know, other blue collar jobs, but I'd never done heavy industrial construction, which is similar to the oil field. And, you know, it's just it's a job where you can get killed on the job. You can get hurt really, really bad. And if you don't do a good job, you can hurt somebody else really bad. And it's all men, you know, so people are pretty rough about how they, how they treat each other, how they talk. And some of it's just, there's a positive element to it because it keeps you from screwing up and you learn fast. And then, you know, some people take it too far. Some people are just mean And when you're kind of around people who are even play acting at being mean for long enough, people get really pretty angry, you know? So, but you know, I do find, I'm pretty good at, making friends, you know, and I like people, I'm drawn to people and to interesting people. And I love joking around and that kind of thing, you know, meant that I definitely found my place. And the relationships and the friendships I have out there, I adore them, you know, they're really incredibly important to me.
One of the things that almost everybody that I've talked to who's read the book brings up this idea that you bring up, which is that so many of the oil field workers had rough fathers, like you described yourself having.
Yeah.
And you talk about the Williston hello that includes a reference to like, oh yeah, man, my dad used to really beat my butt, you know?
Yeah.
And I'm just curious what you're hearing in terms of response to the book and that issue.
I mean, I think that's one of the main things that sticks out to people, or that people identify with, you know, who read the book, is this idea of the father wound, right? So I got the idea from this pastor, Joe Ehrman, who's a former Baltimore Colts football player. He describes it as a hole in a man's heart that's in the shape of his father, a wound. So the father wound. And, you know, it's, I didn't do a study on it, you know, but it is, it stuck out to me that when I'd sit down at a bar in Williston, guys who were looking for work would start the conversation out by talking about how their dads had whipped them, you know, and it was a way it was something that kind of created a sense of camaraderie. They were definitely guys who had great fathers, you know, who go into that line of work. But since then, I've found more, you know, they have, there's a test, I'm not going to remember what it's called, but it has to do with basically at like childhood adversity. And they find that, and it's maybe 20 questions. And if you go through, if you have a certain amount of, you answer, they're sort of like, have you ever worried about you weren't going to have food to eat? You know, when you were a child, you know, or has a parent ever struck you? And so there's these kind of lists of what makes a person, you know, kind of fit that profile. And I recently was listening to a podcast about the Navy SEALs. And there's a recruiter from the Navy SEALs who said that he looked for people with high scores in those tests, which is interesting, right? And, you know, he said, look, these are guys who are drawn to high risk stuff. Brotherhood is incredibly important to them. If you didn't ever had a dad, like your friends become your dad. And they're more competitive and these different things like that. So I found that to be kind of validating of what I was saying with the same thing, with just kind of being drawn to dangerous work because you come from a dangerous place. It kind of calms your nervous system.
Yeah. You know, I was struck by, I've read a few memoirs about being in the military. Just last year, I read one by a Minnesota author, Matt Young, called Eat the Apple. Being in the Marines. Yeah, the similarity of the workplace experience to what you experienced in the oil field was something there. Could that kind of work happen without that kind of craziness? Or do you think it just, that's like inherent?
Well, it's a good question. I think that it's somewhat inherent. I think that the issue is sort of like, is there a way to utilize that experience, that people have that experience, and a way to utilize them in like a productive way in society that doesn't exploit them? And I think that the danger is that you get into situations where people who have that scar, you know, in their lives, that they are exploited for that and used in a way that doesn't benefit them, you know, but might benefit society, but that doesn't benefit them. And I think the key is making sure that those kind of jobs do both.
Well, and that, of course, calls to mind a memorable passage to me in the book. You're back in Brooklyn. You're getting some feelings of maybe people are kind of looking down a little bit on the oil field workers. And you talk about how these people in New York City will benefit more from the oil boom than the workers in Williston ever will.
Yeah.
And ties into this as a this is a bit of a working class epic, this book.
Yeah, absolutely.
Blue collar. And how do you feel about being, you know, there's been a few books like that lately. A famous one is Hillbilly Elegy, and Sarah Smarsh wrote one, and there's some different ones out there. How do you feel about being kind of grouped into that as like an oracle of the working class?
Yeah, well, I think just the point is important, and it's important. And I love New York. I mean, I lived there for 8 years. I mean, I love that city, but it's important for these coastal cities and people to have some gratitude, I think, for working people and for what extractive communities kind of put out there. And, you know, and yeah, as far as being grouped with J.D. Vance and those guys, I think it's great. Like, I don't have, I don't think that there's not enough. There needs to be more working class writers. There's not enough there. And so it's a little funny, I think, how kind of small of a group it is, but it's taken on outside significance because all of these writers live in New York. They plop down in Kansas for a week at a diner and they ask people, what do you think of Joe Biden? And they get, you know, aggravated answers. It's just like if somebody, you know, from North Dakota popped down in like Broadway in full camo and like sat there at a table and asked everybody, you know, what do you think about Donald Trump? It would be like, nobody's going to give you a straight answer. So you need people who actually are working class. I think that one thing that I love, you know, there's also Tara Westover's book Educated, which is, I think, maybe the best of the bunch. But there's an interesting thing in those books that my book is different because J.D. Vance went to Harvard Law School. Tara Westover, her book's called Educated. She, you know, became, I think she's has a doctorate. I think Sarah Smarsh has a doctorate.
Yeah.
You know, so all those books end with the working class person going through a very high education system and sort of joining the elite, the liberal elite, right? I guess JD's a conservative, but in my book, at the end of my book, I'm working as a junk hauler. You know, I'm interested in getting my college degree, but I don't have one. And for me, I think that's a fine choice. You know, I think that's a fine choice. And I think it would be great to have, I honestly think I get a little blowback from my book because of the fact that it doesn't end that way, that it doesn't have me becoming, you know, joining the club at Harvard or whatever. And I've been, you know, there have been people who have said, well, what's the transformation? He doesn't really, he just kind of comes home from work and he's a mess, you know. And for me, you know, the transformation in the book, well, it's all throughout the book, but it's like, for a guy with my background, with my experiences, to actually finish a book and get it published is almost a transformation in itself. It's like you're holding the transformation. whereas, I should be, you know, drunk somewhere and not getting much stuff done. But I think that it would be better. I think one of the problems with, you know, there's all this focus on diversity now, which is great, but I feel a bit like we miss the idea of sort of class diversity and educational diversity. Some of the smartest people I've ever met in my life are guys who are, you know, do construction work and that kind of thing. And they go home and they read and they self-educate themselves and they're, you know, whip smart.
That's Bill Thomas talking with Michael Patrick F. Smith, the author of The Good Hand, a memoir about working in the Bakken. We'll have more after this break.
We'd like to thank the North Dakota Council on the Arts for supporting arts programming here on Prairie Public.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg, and today on this Labor Day, we are having a conversation about working. The Good Hand, a memoir of work, brotherhood, and transformation in an American boomtown is by Michael Patrick F. Smith, and it's about his time working in the Bakken. It is part of the One Book, One North Dakota webinar series put on by Humanities ND. We pick up that conversation now between Smith and our very own Bill Thomas.
You have I think what they call it is a nuanced position on the oil industry that that I probably disappoints some conservationists and also disappoints the oil industry people.
Yeah, it's it is super. I find it to be incredibly complicated and very nuanced issue. I've kind of catch hell from both sides for my opinions on it. But I think right now, you know, oil is just, it's absolutely essential to everything that we do. And so to me, that's kind of undeniable. If you have everything is, my computer is made out of oil, our clothes are made out of oil, the paint on the walls is made out of oil, all of our pharmaceuticals require petrochemicals to be purified. Petrochemicals are in our fertilizer. So it's just undeniable that it's in every single thing. I also believe that global warming is a big problem. And I think that trying to transition away from oil is important. I think we're always going to have it. We're always going to need natural gas. We're always going to need oil. But to try to, you know, make the imprint smaller, I think is important. And for me, you know, I was criticized because I testified before Congress a couple months ago. I was invited by the Democrats. And for me, the main point that I was kind of trying to push and that I write about every time someone lets me write an article is that if there is going to be this investment in solar and wind energy, can we put it in North Dakota? Can we put it in Kentucky? Can we put it in areas that have had coal mining and an oil industry? Can we put it in those communities so that there are still, so that jobs stay there? And I don't know that anybody's listening to me, but I find that that's a position that I feel I can strongly advocate for, you know. And then besides that, when it comes to the oil industry, I think that, and this isn't even specific to the oil industry, but I think when it comes to multinational corporate conglomerates that rule the earth, I think they should pay people better. And I think they should give better benefits. And I think that if you're talking about $80,000 a year working on an oil rig, it's like, that sounds like great money, but then you figure you're doing 14-hour days. So it's not like you're working an 8-hour day in the office and then you can have a life outside of that. Like, you are working, you're endangering your life. And at the end of the day, it ends up not being that much money. Anybody who lived in Williston knows how high the rent was out there, you know? So it becomes this kind of system. And I think that the companies and the federal government, that they have a responsibility to try to kind of help out these towns. And I think that oil companies don't do a good enough job with, they can just do better, you know?
Yeah, talking about Williston, and the sense you get reading the book is that working in the oil fields was so consuming and exhausting, and survival and sleeping in a flop house and all the different parts, that you didn't really get a chance to interact much with a lot of the life in Williston. I think there's a point where you're talking to some theater people who like doing something in the high school or the college or something.
Right.
And you just can't connect. Right? There's just not time or energy or?
Yeah. I was at my friend's house. He was a crane operator and his wife worked in the public school system in Williston, and they were putting on a musical. And, you know, I come from theater. I love the arts. You know, it was sort of a realization for me that I was like, oh, it'd be really like rewarding to help out. And then the realization, just like, there's no way, you know, I never know when I'm getting home from work at 8 p.m. I'm waking up at 5 a.m. to go to work, and I'm not getting home till 8 in the evening. And I literally, the only thing I can do is take off my greasers, hop in the shower, eat a sandwich and go to bed. And I think that, you know, I met some guys, some people love the work. I loved the work. So I never want to denigrate it, but I know that there were older guys who had real regrets kind of about how they'd missed holidays. They'd missed this and that. They hadn't, you know, they'd missed a lot of things because, it is such all consuming labor.
Referring back to your transformation, I guess I took it to be the transformation of your confidence in your relations to other people and the development of this brotherhood that you felt? That seemed like an important thread in the book.
I think that, you know, that was important to me. And the, you know, like I said, the friendships that I made out there, there's something special about them. And some of it was kind of accepting myself in that way. You know, I'm weird for an oil field hand. I'm also weird for like a theater guy. You know, I don't fully fit in that way in the New York world. I was always a little bit rougher than people or a little bit different, you know, to them. So in some ways I feel like the transformation was kind of fusing these parts of myself and accepting like, well, this is who I am. I love theater. I also worked in the oil field, you know, and kind of finding some a little bit more peace with myself.
Here's an oil industry question from Gary. He wants to know, have you seen this movie called There Will Be Blood?
Yeah.
Yeah. He wonders if there's similarities to that in the North Dakota oil industry.
Yeah. I mean, you know, there's a, you know, I guess that movie set in the 1800s or so. No, I guess the early 1900s.
Yeah, early. Yeah.
You know, I think that there's some of the ruthlessness. I mean, you could imagine a Daniel Plainview. Or you can imagine that character kind of stomping around in the scoria for sure. You know, it's not really as you don't have the blowouts, you know, that you see in kind of cartoons or in that movie where the oil blows out and everybody has to run away. So they figured that out, which is good. But I think that there's some fun. There are some funny, some interesting similarities.
I mean, what's your sense of the working process out in the field away from the multinational corporate headquarters and out where the rigs are?
You know, I've heard too, it's interesting. I have heard from people that they feel that it's become a lot safer too. I get that one as well. And it's great if it has become a lot safer. I think, you know, in my experience, it could be that, you know, the safety man at the company I worked at wasn't very good. You know, I worked at one company and that was the experience I saw. I think that the work, you know, the work is dangerous no matter what you do. And it's interesting in that I think that there is some value, and it's basically bottom up from the safety perspective. Like it's basically the guys doing the work have to keep each other safe and have to try to do that themselves. I think more than like, I don't know if it would be better to have a bunch more top down safety stuff going on. I think sometimes when that happens, you just have too many people staring over your shoulder and it can encourage accidents as well.
Well, have you got a segment to read for us?
Yeah, I have.
I'd love to hear it.
So this is a section that happens pretty late in the book. I've been working in the oil field for a long time, you know, through the summer and fall, and it's deep into the winter. I'll just give it a read. Huck is my buddy who's a fellow swamper who I'm working with. Chapter's called Sundogs. The horizon is all shades of white. Snow falls on a windy slant and holds tight to the prairie's dirt crust, sparkling and reflecting. Ice grapples a million glittering stalks of grass, rigidly waving and clinking against each other. The whole sky is a single cloud stretched thin. Huck and I leave the crane pickup and walk into the insanity of cold. The very air sparkles as the moisture in the atmosphere freezes before our eyes in undulating, shimmering waves. Huck dances forward and points toward the sun, raising its cold white head in the east. The sun looks tall and pinched, not like an orb, but in the devilish shape of a goat's pupil. Circling the sun is a purely symmetrical crown of light. There they are, Huck says, the sundogs. In the ring of the halo, on the same eye level as the sun, an arm's length to the left and right of the goat's pupil, burn two mock suns. The fiery, outstretched hands of an ancient winter god inviting praise. Pretty cool, huh? Says Huck. It is pretty cool, I say. It is negative 38 degrees in the Bakken. We get to work. The day smears past. The soft sound of snow rustling on snow, the tinkle of frozen stalks of prairie grass, generators and idling trucks. The rip of a wild wind through location peels the snow from the earth and sends it spiraling sideways through the machines, through the zippers of our work clothes. A flake of snow licking the neck feels like a cold fist. Chains rattle and gear shift. The sundogs move higher into the white, stretching into day. Huck appears, big and commanding. His normal awkwardness gone, his body poised and moving, legs, arms, and head in perfect tandem with the crane. He's throwing hooks, shortening chains, and racing after trucks. No words are spoken in the silent dim. I watch him as he kneels next to me, his mask covering his face except for the pink around the eyes. Icicles extend his eyelashes, delicate, otherworldly, feminine, as his eyebrows fill with ever-growing glacial amounts of ice. A flea's Antarctica. Huck rigs a piece of metal to the gin truck and disappears after it. I climb into the pickup to warm up. Pulling off my hood and mask, I feel the ice on my skin melting. Tiny rivulets of water run down my coat. Wet face, wet jacket, blowing into hands, rubbing eyes. The company radio buzzes with trash talk. Rubbing hands together, stomping feet, closing eyes and breathing deep. Don't pull off your boots and don't stay too long. Don't let the feet warm up. Get too warm and it only gets worse. If you let your feet sweat, the moisture freezes as soon as you're outside. Ice in your boot ain't just cold, it's mean. Unrelenting, unforgiving, unshakable. Cold as a burn, like an impact driver to the foot. So get out, but it's so warm in the truck. But get out, just a moment longer. No, get out. Back into the cold, moving into the white. Part of the machine, part of the snow, a son of the sundogs. Swinging chains and rigging hooks, keeping legs moving, keeping arms moving, moving body across the hard earth, crunch of boots, crunch of metal where the black gold flows. I stop for a moment, just a moment. I close my eyes. It's a simple moment of rest as the crane idles by the substructure of the rig. I exhale through my mask, but when I try to reopen my eyes, I can't. My eyelashes are frozen shut, fused together by ice. My gloves are covered in invert and diesel. I can't touch them to my face. I pull off my right-hand glove with my left hand. Immediately, all feeling leaves the exposed hand. I can't open it or close it. It sits at the end of my arm, a useless piece of meat. I paw at my eyes to brush the ice off my eyelashes. My hand is awkward, a tool as a man could wield. But it works. I can see again. I blink my eyes free. I look at my hand. A meaty red paw. Hurriedly, I attempt to put my glove back on, but it won't fit. I can't will my fingers to conform to the fingers of the glove. I try again, but I'm moving too fast. My fingers won't move. They won't slide into the glove. I slow my breath. I fight my panic, and I deliberately, slowly fitting the glove around my foreign hand. I get it on and then bury my hand under my armpit to warm it. I hear a horn. The crane swings around the north end of location. I move after it.
Wow. Beautifully read, beautifully written. A great description that all of us on have experienced that North Dakota winter, though maybe not out having to move an oil rig in the middle of it.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
That I see why you read it out loud. Yeah. I wish I'd been saying it out loud when I read it. Yeah. Part of that gets into it. Eileen Tronis Nelson, who's on the webinar, she says, Michael, when you say the work is dangerous, could you expand on the dangerousness? I think maybe that reading just did in a way.
Yeah, that gives a little sense of it. The weather is a factor in the slickness of everything. I think the main thing is that there's just giant pieces of steel. And so the steel is just moving around all the time and trucks are moving around. And there's just not much room for error.
So you wrote this book that's this combination of meditation on personal psychology and the oil industry and North Dakota and cold weather and sundogs and everything. So after you got this book out, you weren't able to tour with it, right?
No, I wasn't because of the pandemic. So it's all been almost all been Zoom, Zoom stuff. Yeah, I was able to do one reading, which was really nice. So I'm hoping that when the paperback comes out next year, that I'm going to try to hit the road and get around with it because I do enjoy, I really enjoy reading it. And I enjoy it's such a solitary process to write a book that it's, I'm a pretty outgoing person. And so the chance to share it with people and meet people is such of the reward for it. It's been hard not being able to enjoy that as much as I'd like to.
So besides, you know, supporting this book, what are you working on? What do you do after you write a book like this?
Yeah, well, I've been casting about a little bit, kind of, I'm doing a little bit of journalism as those opportunities kind of roll in. And I'm working toward writing my next book. I'm still kind of feeling out what it is. So I don't have any kind of good scoop to tell you. But and then also I've been working on music a lot. So I'm going into the studio. I actually was in the studio. I recorded a song just about a month ago with a friend in Los Angeles. And then I'm going into the studio here in Kentucky to cut a full album in September.
Here's somebody wonders, Laura says, would you ever come back to work if the oil business picked up again? Would you come back to work in the oil?
You know, I was really tempted to not long after I'd left. In the years after I left, I was pretty tempted to head back. But at that point, it had kind of busted around 2015. I think now I was kind of old for a guy to start in the oil field in my mid-30s. I'm 45 now, so I don't think that I'm going to jump into work that's quite that intense. So, but yeah. Hopefully I can keep the writing thing going and I won't have to do anything too extreme.
One of the things that we who live in North Dakota appreciated about the book is you did, even though you were so focused in on your work and so consumed with it and with the energy, you did include some stuff about North Dakota. And, you know, like you go down to the Badlands and I'm going like, oh, I've been to the Badlands. Yeah. You know,
yeah.
What prompted you to put in those kind of portraits of local North Dakota?
I think that, you know, the North Dakota is like a big character in the book is kind of how I think about it. So it was trying to just honor the place. And North Dakota is also just so endlessly fascinating to me. You know, it seems like I was surprised at how much history I found and then how much kind of cool stuff like the Badlands, or whether it's, you know, the story of Teddy Roosevelt's time in the Badlands.
Yeah, and that kind of resonated with your own personal story.
Yeah, it did, you know. So I kept kind of just trying to find all the different ways that things kind of reflected off each other in that way, you know, and the way that, yeah, Roosevelt's story reflected me back at me, or the way that the land kind of what it evoked. You know, I just think that, you know, I did hit a point where I was trying to, you know, find new ways to describe the prairie. You know, I ended up reading like any book I could find that was sort of set in the prairie so that I could look for just some adjectives to talk about it.
Did you find some that were helpful?
I found a couple of things. I don't remember what I kind of cribbed from people, but.
Well, okay. So what, but talking about other books, that is one of the things I wanted to ask you about is, have you read other books about the Bakken and the oil boom, or that they kind of cover some of this territory?
Yeah, I've read a bit, you know, I definitely read, I think most of the research I did was more about the beginning of the oil industry. So I read a lot of books about Pit Hole, Pennsylvania, which was the very first oil boom. And then, you know, it was fun seeing Clay Jenkinson at the beginning of this, his Lewis and Clark journals that he edited and wrote the foreword to. I found that to be very helpful. And then I don't know, you know, there was another book about the boom that I read at one point. It's called maybe The New Wild West, I think is what it's called. I thought it was pretty interesting. I didn't feel like it really got to the heart of what I was trying to write about or the way that I had experienced it. So it's a little bit of, you know, some of it when, you know, when I started writing the book, I spent about a year working on a draft of the first 150 pages. And at the end of that, I thought I was going to submit it. But at the end of that, I realized that I'd kind of written the wrong book. Like I'd written a book that sounded like somebody else and sounded like I was trying to sound like a journalist or I was trying to be someone else. And it kind of, so I pretty much trashed it and started over. And I found,
boy, us non-writers, when we hear about a writer doing that, it's like, seems like, what? You took all that work and like,
It was not easy. It was not easy to do. And when I didn't, but I just realized it wasn't going anywhere. And what I did was I wrote one paragraph that I knew that I was like, this paragraph is right. This is what it's about. And then I wrote about it. And then I wrote a 10-page chapter that actually it mostly stayed in the book. And I said, well, this is what the book is. And then I put it aside for about 6 months and just didn't, I couldn't bring myself to look at it. But when I got back to it, that's what I got back to. And I figured out what my voice was.
Yeah. Oh boy. What a way to work on things. You know, a question that occurred to me earlier when the question came up about there will be blood and, how that corresponds to the oil industry. Has anybody talked to you about making a movie based on this book?
They have. So I'm in talks. Hopefully I'll be able to announce something pretty soon. I think it's kind of hush hush, but I'm in talks with a company about a TV show. And so they've acquired the rights to it, and we'll see how it goes.
That could be really interesting.
Huh? Yeah, yeah, it could be really exciting. Yeah.
So when you look at the back of the book, what are your favorite parts of the book?
You know, that section that I just read, I think, is one of my favorite. I think the stuff about my family was the hardest to write. And that came really late in the process when they sort of made the decision to write so specifically about my siblings and about growing up. I hadn't really intended to do that. And when I did it, I basically gave all those pages to my brothers and sisters. And I said, hey, I'm writing about us. And like, if you have feedback, if you don't want me to say something, I won't say it, you know, I'm willing to kind of work with you guys. And they were all incredibly supportive.
Really?
So it was the worst part to write. And I don't really particularly, I never read from those sections. It's not fun for me to read them because they're painful. But I think that doing that brought me closer to my siblings in a really foundational way. And I think that the book has been healing for not just for me, but also for them. So I guess I'd be inclined to say that would kind of my favorite passages in a way for the effect that they've had.
So last question, what do you hope people will get from this book?
I hope that people who work in the industry or just work in any kind of hard job, I hope that they feel seen and that they feel that it makes them proud. So that's a big one to me. You know, people say, well, who did you write the book for? And the truth is I wrote the book for people who work in the oil field. It's not a very big audience, you know, in the grand scheme of book publishing. And that's not something I advertised to my publisher. But the entire time I was thinking, is this going to show, are people who have done the work going to respect this? And are they going to see themselves in it? And people who lived in the community, are those people going to see themselves in it and understand their community a little better and, you know, feel maybe, you know, there's obviously a lot of ambivalence in the book, but also I think pride is part of it too. And a positive pride.
All right. Yeah. Okay. Well, Michael, thank you so much for writing this book and thank you for taking this time to talk with us about it.
Yeah. Thank you so much for having me. This has been really great. I appreciate it very much.
That was director of radio Bill Thomas speaking with Michael Patrick F. Smith about his book, The Good Hand, a memoir of work, brotherhood, and transformation in an American boomtown. The book is widely available. That conversation was part of the One Book, One North Dakota webinar series, and you can find out more at humanitiesnd.org. Dakota Datebook is next.
I'm Capri Cafaro, host of Eat Your Heartland Out. Coming up, we will meet leaders in the Indigenous food sovereignty movement who are using food to both empower and inspire. Individuals from the Oglala Lakota, Ho-Chunk, and Lake Superior Chippewa communities remind us that there would be no Midwestern food story without the Indigenous peoples who were first to inhabit those lands and still do today.
Eat Your Heartland Out, coming up Tuesday night at 8 Central, 7 Mountain, on Prairie Public.
This is Dakota Datebook for September 6th. Roger Maris, Fargo and North Dakota's hometown hero,
lost his 37-year-old home run record to St. Louis slugger Mark McGwire in September of 1998. Baseball's waning days that September had christened a new member of batter royalty. Maris had topped the beloved Babe Ruth's home run record, and not all baseball fans had been rooting for him. Sportscaster Boyd Christensen wrote, "There was an attitude of fans and writers alike that if anyone was going to break Ruth's record, it should be Rogers' more popular teammate, Mickey Mantle." The Forum newspaper highlighted a McGwire's quote on page one, uttered while he was holding the famous bat Maris had used in setting the record in 1961. McGwire said, "Roger, I hope you're with me tonight." When Boyd Christensen interviewed Roger on his popular Boyd Christian Interviews show on Prairie Public Television, the famous but well-known introverted player revealed more about himself than most fans had ever seen. Boyd wrote about the interview in his 1983 book about his most memorable interviews, saying, "I'm a fan of Roger Maris. I don't claim to know the man. I've interviewed him on two occasions and found his candor and intelligent insights into his sport a refreshing departure from the time-worn clichés." It should have been a happy time for Maris, but the 1961 season and subsequent years in New York left some scars. Roger passed away at the age of 51 from non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. The Sanford Roger Maris Cancer Center is named in his honor. The Roger Maris All-Star Week, which includes a celebrity golf tournament, has been an important fundraising event for decades, supporting youth development and the Cancer Center. In 1998, the Forum newspaper contacted baseball legend Yogi Berra to send a letter about his longtime teammate Roger and the new record set by McGwire. On Yogi's personal stationery, the old Yankee favorite penned, "Greetings to the people of Fargo. As one of Roger's teammates, I share with you the pride in his long-standing home run record. This is the first time in baseball history when the home run record wasn't held by a Yankee. Thanks for your support of my old friend. Best regards, Yogi Berra." Today's Dakota Datebook is written by Steve Stark. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
That's it for this Monday edition of Main Street. Coming up tomorrow on the show, Open Mind ND works with people and families dealing with mental health concerns. We visit with the president, Ryan Randall. That's coming up tomorrow on Main Street. Until then, enjoy the rest of your Labor Day.